Here! What for did you pull the communication cord?
To stop the train, you old fool.
It's against all the regulations to stop the train on the bridge.
But a man jumped off.
He's a madman. We've got to take him.
Which way did he go?
He must have jumped off here. I cannot see him.
You sure he jumped?
Anyway, I cannot wait here any longer.
There he is, getting on the train.
No, that's a passenger.
It's he, I tell you.
Come on with you then.
Height, about 5'10". Small moustache. Last seen wearing a dark suit, but he may have obtained a change of clothing.
Do you expect me to talk?
Hello and welcome to episode 245 of Do You Expect Us to Talk? As always, I'm Becca and joined by my fellow co-hosts Chris and Dave. How are you both?
Good evening, folks.
Good evening, everybody.
Yeah.
Especially when I'm being chased across the
I think that's the definitive introduction.
Paused up there because I was gonna do like a Mr. Memory sort of thing to start off with, and I completely bottled.
Oh, I thought you were going to say you forgot. That would be perfect, wouldn't it? I was going to do a Mr. Memory thing, but I forgot.
Well, that would be funnier.
Yeah, it would be, but... So, yeah, well done.
I've even paused up that. There we are.
So, yeah. I think we should improve movies, and I was saying that they should have gone for 37 steps to save themselves some energy. But anyway, that leads us on to what are we covering tonight, Becca?
I think I did the 156 steps because I've seen like all the versions.
Yeah, you saw it four times, so yeah, 156
steps.
Yes,
I did all the steps.
Yeah.
Yes,
which
tonight.
Is the superior version, in your opinion? Is it this
one? Oh gosh,
one?
We'll get to it. We'll get to it.
Okay.
Yeah, tonight we're getting our step counted in, as we skip a few films and go to the original 1935 of the 39 steps. Before we open, for this series, I'd like to try and open like with a quote or a review of a film. The most famous review is quite long, but this one, I've got a naughty limerick, if it's okay with you guys.
All right.
It's not too beyond the realms of...
I mean, I'm wondering how this is going to go, because Steps doesn't even rhyme with like muff or anything.
This is a bit naughty, but not safe for work, right. But it appears in the film, so here we go. There's a naughty limerick that is in the film. There was a young lady from Ongar who had an affair with a conger. I said, well, how does it feel to sleep with an eel? She said, just like a man, only longer. So there we are. Just thought I'd like to include that. Might be a bit fun, I don't know.
I just want to know what causes Pip and Poultry.
Well, I've got a fun fact about that coming up later on as well.
Yeah.
Now, they make stuff so common, Chris.
Yeah, I was just going for the uncomfortable silence there, because you're never that comfortable being naughty. And I thought, if I leave a sort of blank space, you'll be like, oh my God, what have I done?
Yeah, I was like, shit, oh my God, I fell flat. No, I thought it was quite, it's exemplary, because obviously Hitchcock was known for his kind of impish, like, naughty sense of humour. And I like how in the film, like, they just say the first line, and then it's cut. And it's obviously, that's not going to, even though this was kind of pre-code-ish, just on that line.
Yeah.
It
no,
still didn't
this
make
is,
it
this
pass.
Is this. I think this is postcode.
Just. Oh, okay. Oh, yes. It was 34, wasn't it? 35. Yeah.
Something like that.
But I thought obviously that had to be chopped out. So I thought, well, we'll include it here. And it's one. It's a limerick I never heard of as well. So there you go. I learned something new and naughty.
About a woman putting eels inside herself.
Yes, eels up inside you.
Okay.
So it's also a Mighty Beast reference, folks.
If it's an electric eel, is that like a natural vibrator?
That's going in the train.
you know.
It just sounds all a bit fishy to me.
Mm, yeah. Anyway, so yeah, this is the first time I've ever seen this. The first awareness I had of the 39 Steps as a film story, anything else, was I think when I saw Jesus of Nazareth, the Zeffirelli miniseries from 1977. Someone said to me, he's best known for the 39 Steps. And they were, of course, referring to Robert Powell, who made a version of that the year after this. And that's all I really knew about it. And then it became a Hitchcock, you know, then I found it was a Hitchcock film. It became a Hitchcock film, always was. But I wasn't particularly aware of it. So this is my first viewing tonight of any version of the 39 Steps. What are the other versions, Becca? So obviously we've got this, and we got the Robert Powell version from 1978. What else was there?
So let me just scroll down, because it's also a fun fact, because I couldn't find any other fun facts. Yeah, so basically, obviously you've got this one, you've got the 70s version of Robert Powell, you've got the 1959 version. Let me just try and find it, sorry. With Tanya Elg and Kenneth Moore. And then also in 2008, you got a made-for-TV version, which I think was for the BBC, with Rupert Penry-Jones. And I think that's kind of more in line with the original film and
for,
the original
for those
film
who don't
well.
know, Rupert Penry-Jones, the only thing we've ever covered him in, he was the mayor who was killed at the very start of the Batman.
Yeah, I totally forgot he was in it. Mm. And he'll pop up. There's a certain film which I probably won't mention now because it doesn't relate. He'll pop up when we get on further in the series as well.
And he was also in a BBC television series called Spooks, which is about MI5, but it's actually called MI5 in the United States.
Yeah,
possibly because Spooks is a racial slur over there.
Probably. Also, yeah. If you've seen the crime series Whitechapel, he was also in that as the male lead.
Okay.
I think there was a period, kind of 2006, 2007, 2008, when like he was in everything. Yeah. There was no escaping him. He was just in all the things.
And he must be talented because he's overcome being called Rupert.
Yes.
Rupert. I mean, you've got to be talented if you put in a CV that says Rupert Penry-Jones and still get jobs. So
fun
yeah,
fact, when we got Alfie, he was called Rupert, but we didn't like the name, so we called him Alfie instead. So there we are. That's our fun fact.
Oh, about your dog?
When he came to us, he was called Rupert, but we didn't fancy calling out Rupert across the field.
Yeah, he was so a Staffordshire Bull Terrier, wasn't he? Who passed away four or five years ago?
He was a little stuffy boy.
Yeah, he was beautiful. You used to post a lot of photos of him.
Yes, he was a little boy. But yeah, he was Rupert, but we didn't like the name, so we called him Alfie instead. And yeah, which he was a bit of a tearaway, so that name suited him better. So.
Better
anyway,
than Rupert, yes.
Better Rupert.
You can't imagine Rupert being a tearaway, can you?
No, Rupert isn't a stuffy name. It's probably more like a spaniel name or a more better behaved dog.
If you've got a dog called Rupert, write to us at expectustotalk@gmail.com.
Looking forward to it.
So, anyway, let's start with some opening thoughts then. So, it is my first viewing, so I've literally just finished it in the last half an hour. Never saw it before. Was pleasantly surprised in several ways, but I will say the second half was stronger. And what I mean by that is, I've talked about this in previous weeks, how up till about 1940, I'm not quite sure what the talkie standard is for films. And the first half, to me, felt a bit stiff. You know, just the performances were all very well spoken. And
it's a bit chubbly warmer, isn't it?
It is a bit chubbly warmer.
It was a bit life in 1990. So I wasn't sure about that. And then the second half of it, all of a sudden, when he's sort of with the female lead of the film, it suddenly becomes really playful, because I remember thinking in the first half, this is like North by Northwest with all the charm and humour removed. And then the sort of second half of the film, they've suddenly got this playful banter that reminded me of It Happened One Night.
Yes.
So, yeah, It Happened One Night is Clark Gable and Claudette Colbert, I think she's
Claudette
called.
Claudette Colbert, yeah, and Clark Gable.
It's 1930-something. It's before It's a Wonderful Life, but it's a Frank Capra film. And it's really playful and really fun and, like... as old-fashioned as some of these things can see, like you can see what a star Clark Gable was in that film, And this film kind of reminded me of that. Robert Donat's an actor I only really know from Goodbye, Mr. Chips, which has been in two versions. It's the whole teaching career of a guy. He loses his wife fairly early in his in their marriage. And it just takes you through his entire teaching career and his impact at a school. It was remade with Martin Clunes for ITV.
I've seen that. That's really good.
It's actually really good. It's got an actress called Victoria Hamilton, I think she's called, in it as his wife. And she's best known for stage now, although she was in a sitcom called The Savages years ago. And it's really, really good. Normally, sort of ITV remakes of films are not really worth the effort, but this was actually pretty good. So I knew Robert Donat from that, and I really wasn't sure about him in the first half of this film. But what we're left with, Becca messaged us tonight about, you know, recording and everything else and still on for tonight and all that sort of thing. And I remember saying, she said what time she'd be available, and I said, I'm going to be a bit later than that because I'm still watching. And she said, it really whips along, doesn't it? And she's right. This is the first film that, like, I feel like the art form's matured enough for some sort of sense of pacing, because all the films we've covered so far have been a bit up and down that way.
Yeah, sorry.
It's got a real nice... I've enjoyed most of them, but this has got a really nice sort of much more modern pacing. It's still got that sort of stiff acting that will sort of slowly disappear, and there's no doubt he will work with a lot more sort of charismatic actors as we go forward. Because my first thought, and I'll talk about it more as we go through, but my first thought really is this is like watching a prototype of North by Northwest, in that there's, you know, a sort of airborne thing chasing him, a bit like North by Northwest. There's a guy caught up in a sort of murder conspiracy he doesn't completely understand. There's a woman he meets on a train who gets caught up with it, exactly the same. It finishes at a famous landmark for Mount Rushmore, the London Palladium, which is still probably the most famous theatre in London, and certainly the biggest of the West End theatres. So I was seeing a lot of that about it, and I was seeing a lot of, not so much in the first half, as I say, I thought the first half was enjoyable, I was enjoying it, but it felt like it didn't have the humour of some of his later films, and then it all kicks in the second half, and there's a really sort of, I hate the word, but banter between the two leads. And suddenly this feels like a Hitchcock film. I now feel like he's arrived and we're going to see a lot of the things we see a lot. Now, we've already seen the finish at a famous landmark. We had the British Museum a few weeks ago. But obviously we're going to see a lot of that through various films. It's got the sort of man caught up in a much, much wider conspiracy. There's the Platinum Blonde meeting on a train. Yeah, there's a lot to it, and there's a bit of sort
there's of the humour as well.
Just silly things. I thought of Blackadder when he was shot, and the fucking like, prayer book stopped it, and I thought of my cigarillo case from, you know, Blackadder the Third. I thought of a lot of different things as I went through it.
Oh no, it's in the other jacket.
Oh no, it's in the other, at the end of the final episode of Blackadder the Third, yeah. He thinks he's been saved by a cigarillo case, and he realises it's not there, so he's dead anyway. I would say this is the best experience I've had so far. I think we are moving into something very recognisably Hitchcock, and I had a great time with it. What about you guys?
I mean, I pretty much just agree with that. For me, it's just you can kind of see that the trope's creeping in now. I mean, you know, compares to the Man Who Knew Too Much last time, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
It's a, you know, that kind of similar kind of
caught up in something bigger than yourself. Yeah, I mean, that's very like North by Northwest. It's very like a lot of films. It's just with my knowledge being not completely lacking, but somewhat. You go for the obvious and famous examples because there's probably loads of other examples I've either not seen or I've forgotten. Do you know what I mean?
But it's that, yeah, that ordinary man caught up in in espionage, caught up in danger. You know, that plus with a little bit of random humour, which I think worked better this time around than previous one. It felt less random. It felt more organic this time around. So. With the humour, but yeah, I see see what Dave means when things kind of pick up a little bit, sort of more halfway through, because he's not really with the lead girl really till like halfway through.
No, he just playfully sexually assaults her on a train, you know, that's all.
Just casually tries to kiss her. Like,
But yeah, so mixed feelings about some of the leads. I think strangely enough, and I think Becca knows a lot more about this than I do, but there's always been criticisms of how Hitchcock conceives and directs women, female characters. And I have to say, this is like the second time in a couple of weeks that I'm saying the strongest suit of this film is the female lead. I think she's the strongest thing in it by quite a distance. And it is a bit of a random role in some ways. She just happens to sort of appear again somewhat through the film. But, you know, talking of the North by Northwest parallels, where he's like shot, which we'll get to later because, spoiler alert, he doesn't die and we've given away how. That did remind me of him in sort of James Mason's office. At the house that wasn't his, which we'll get to in several weeks' time. So, yeah, I'm very much feeling Hitchcock here. What I really didn't get until now, because most of the Hitchcock I know is the American stuff, is that this is several weeks in a row now that I've thought, I think Hitchcock had a real fondness for, like, London nightlife, because he often has these sort of, you know, neon and signs, Piccadilly type look at shots of London. He seems very, very fond of that. I would love to have... ironically, I'd almost rather... As good as this film is, and as much as it does stand on its merits, I wish he'd remade this rather than last week's film. I would have loved to have watched a version of this with, like, Jimmy Stewart in it instead.
I think he kind of did, and it was called North by Northwest.
I know.
I know what you mean.
But you know what I mean. You know, yeah. Maybe... Maybe.
Yeah, I think as far as remakes go, like The Man Who Knew Too Much, I'm going to see it on the big screen in a few weeks' time.
Which version?
The Jimmy Stewart one.
Right.
And it's okay. It's not one of my favourites, but I think it's a good film. But it's not the favourite. But I think this would have been a good. I mean, it's been remade many times, but I agree.
For me, this is much better than last week's films, and I think most of the stuff around The Man Who Knew Too Much remake is better than that film. So I don't think that either of them stand as like a complete highlight of his career. So I had a really, really good time with it, and I wasn't sure to start with. I'm not completely sure about Robert Donat. As I say, I best know him. When I think of Robert Donat, I think of him towards the end of Goodbye, Mr. Chips. I think of him as like an old man, which he wasn't. He was just under a lot of makeup. But that is a recommended film. It's a really terrific film. He only made... he had some various health issues that meant he only made about 19 films in his entire career.
Yeah, he had like really bad asthma or something, didn't he, as well? But you wouldn't know it, certainly from this film. Especially where he makes that massive impassioned speech. Right in the middle, you wouldn't know it at all.
You tend to be like a politician or something.
I know, and funny enough, I keep thinking of other films, and not all of them are Hitchcock. So when he got up and gave that political speech, maybe it's... I know you said he probably remade it closely as North by Northwest, but bear in mind, North by Northwest very nearly had Jimmy Stewart in it. And when he got up and gave his political speech, it made me think of Mr. Smith Goes to Washington.
Yes, filibuster scene.
Yeah, because he wants a boys' club, apparently, yes. Which sounds perfectly wholesome.
Scouts.
So yeah, what about you, Becca? You know this film a lot better than me, and you've seen other versions of it. I guess I've got two questions. The obvious one is, what do you make of this? But the second thing would be, how do the versions compare? And I don't mean which is best or a breakdown of all of them. I'm actually just asking that I read that this takes some liberties with the book, and that, so I would imagine other versions have significant differences. I don't know.
I'm going to be a bit of a blasphemer because I haven't actually read the book. I've seen all the sort of film TV versions, I've not seen the stage show, which I really want to because it looks a laugh riot. And there's a couple of really good radio adaptations. I think there's one done by the BBC, which Tom Baker was in, which I haven't listened to, but that sounds really good. But as I say, unfortunately, I've not read John Buchan's book. But apparently it's quite dry and not all that very interesting. I'm going to listen to a quick shout out to Hitchpod, a wonderful podcast from Australia, where Kat Jones and Dan Blucke review all of Hitchcock's films. I think they're currently on the second or third season, so they're working down to the top 20. I think they're on the top 10, so not long to go now. They reviewed this in context with John Buchan's story and said that apparently it was quite poorly written, poorly plotted out, just quite dry in the way it's written. But then it was 1915. But yeah, in terms of all the different versions, I would probably say that obviously this original 1935 and then the 1959 versions are probably quite close. The 59 version isn't like a direct shot-for-shot remake, but it's probably closer in terms of the beats that it makes. and then the two... Excuse me, I do apologise. I was going to cough, sorry. Sorry, right. Yeah, and in terms of the... two other versions that kind of make a mark away from like the original story, I guess, would obviously be the Robert Powell version, which I think probably goes into a bit more, and it shifts the setting again onto like almost the eve of the breakout of the First World War. So it kind of it's more original to that book, but I think it kind of goes a bit deeper, and there are the details are slightly changed as well. So ironically, it's probably closer than the original book, I would say, and the same goes for the 2008 remake as well. Which is one of my favourites because of Rupert Penry-Jones. He's very handsome. But yeah, I do need to read the book, really, considering I've seen most of the versions. But yeah, Dave, interesting that you mention the sort of locations and sort of scenes set around London as well. Hitchcock was kind of from that sort of area anyway. There's a critic and author called Mark Glancy. Recommend you check out his work. That he points out in a study of the film 2003, this was like familiar ground, as obviously he was born and raised in the Nathanson area, and in the East End. So he's really familiar. That was kind of like his old stomping ground, basically. And incidentally, if you go to Nathanson Tube along the Central Line, I think the Tube station is really famous because in early 2000s there is a series of murals that were and mosaics that were commissioned depicting various scenes from the films. So if you can get up there, I highly recommend it. You can probably be there for an afternoon, obviously trying to avoid all the busy commuters. I'll try and post some photos of it on our Twitter feed when this episode goes out. And there's, you know, it's kind of like a local landmark and something that's quite well known in the area as well. So yeah, I'll include a little bit about, as I say, what you said, why I've chosen this film as well. It's basically for all the reasons that you mentioned, Dave. It is very much sort of a proto-spy thriller. I chose this one in particular because it was a huge success for Hitchcock, certainly over here in Britain. But more importantly, it kind of garnered him attention like across the pond as well. So it's one of his first films really to do that. It's one of his first films to garner success in America. In terms of its cultural impact, it is very, as I said, yeah, it's a proto kind of spy thriller almost that, yeah, did arguably inform both North by Northwest and is in remake of The Man Who Knew Too Much. I would argue that Honey is kind of like almost like a proto Bond-ish a little bit, although he's not British. Also in this film, he's apparently from Canada, and he's kind of not doing what he does out of a sense of duty, for example. But and again, it contains like many Hitchcockian elements, as we know, as you mentioned, Dave, the sort of the trope of the innocent man on the run, with often random woman caught up in events as well. Exciting chase, thrilling set pieces, mystery, murder, and an exciting climax. Speaking of Robert Donut, or Hitchcock called him Robert Donut, which is quite funny. I think I've only ever seen him in this film. That's kind of all I know him from.
You haven't seen Goodbye, Mr. Chips,
then? No, I haven't. I've only ever seen the Martin Clunes version, which is excellent.
Well, the Martin Clunes, as I say, it's very good, but one is, what it makes no apologies for is it does feel like a TV miniseries. I don't mean that as a pejorative at all. I just mean it feels like a two-part adaptation or whatever it is. But it's fairly faithful. It's a similar film. It's similar to the film, but they're both very good.
Check it out. Yeah, because I think that's kind of really all I know him from. But yeah, I've seen the Martin Clunes one, which is brilliant. But I've not seen the original.
2002, that was.
Yeah, there was a while ago.
2002, 2001, something like that.
Yeah, in there somewhere. I think because it was before he did the series where he plays a doctor.
Yeah, a year or two before Doc Martin, yeah.
Doc Martin, that was it. Yeah. It just went out of my head. Yeah, so Donut is basically, he's got great charm and charisma and great chemistry with both of his female leads. But Madeline Carroll, she's not in it nearly enough. She needs to be more in this film. So that's probably like my one criticism.
I think it's a major criticism because I think Eva Marie Saint, in the most similar film I can think of to it, takes a little bit longer to come along, but then she's at his side the whole way. Whereas you get teased her, and it feels a strange coincidence when she turns up again, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's a little bit plot contrivance, really. That's,
definitely.
That's the only thing. I mean, it's I'd say this was 1935, so it's, you know, a few years old now, definitely. So you kind of have to sort of forgive it a little bit. But yeah, there are kind of those elements, just as you said, as you were mentioning them, Dave. It was literally just tick, 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 you know, a sort of checklist, really, just going through, yep, that's right, yep, that's there, yep, that's there. And plus you've got a bit of kind of international intrigue going along as well. And also you've kind of got, obviously, World War II looming slightly as well in a few years.
I also like the fact the lead character finishes the film trying to pull over a corpse.
It's a bit risky.
He's a bit like, I'm in here. I know he just died, like, but I'm in here. Yeah.
That's it. And yeah, the, well, the I think it's 59.
You can't take chances while you can, you know.
Yeah, the Kenneth Moore kind of one ends the same way as well. I was actually, just prior to recording this, I was literally just probably about halfway through the 70s version. Because I've seen it, but I've not seen it in a while. I just cannot remember how that ends. But again, they all kind of, again, just to compare all of the versions, they still have to include, obviously, there's that scene where, which we'll get to in a minute, where they arrive at the inn and, you know, she has to take off her wet stockings. Yeah. And he's like, oh, can I help you? And he's like, oh. It's very pervy. But yeah, same sort of thing, really. It kind of cements all those tropes. I mean, you've got Madeline Carroll, who's the Hitchcock blonde. She is like the quintessential Hitchcock blonde. You've got the cameo. You see Hitchcock probably about 7 minutes in.
Where was it? I didn't spot it.
Yeah, it happens really early on, actually. He just drops a bit of litter on the floor. Obviously, the MacGuffin is the 39 steps, so this film might as well be called The MacGuffin. There's a staircase scene. Pamela is eavesdropping on the conversation of the two spies at the hotel. Another trope is the wrong man. Obviously, this is the ultimate wrong man film. Hitchcock would go on to make the film called The Wrong Man, which we won't be covering. But this is probably like the prototype for all those kind of wrong man on the run movies that he would go on to make. What else? Oh yeah, dramatic finale, a landmark. Obviously, you've got everything finishing up at the London Palladium with Mr. Memory. Animals, you've got dogs really early on, and also there's sheep, quite a lot of sheep in this film, as you would expect in the Scottish Highlands. So yeah, you kind of got all the tropes in this one, or say.
A sheep's a trope?
not sheep. Sheep's such, but sheep. But sheep's.
Sheep's, what am I talking about? Not even English. Sheep.
So what is the plural? I think it's sheep. Yeah, no, sorry about that.
The plural of sheep is sheep. Yeah, it is.
Yeah, so English lesson, we do expect to talk. But like animals, or particularly birds, as we'll notice as we go along, but become a trope as well. Obviously, because Hitchcock was a big animal lover. He regularly had dogs. His pets and dogs do pop up in a couple of the films. Like, for example, he's got two Sealyham Terriers, which we'll see in The Birds, in his cameo early on in the film. He's a big animal lover, definitely. So kind of animals and birds do pop up as a trope in his films as well, so it's fun to spot out those as we go along. So, and I think this one you see, is it two or three dogs on the train? And then sheep, whole load of sheep.
I think dramatically we've lost something with those sorts of train carriages not being around anymore.
Yeah, definitely. Yes, because it reminds me of those scenes from like From Rush of Love, for example.
It's much more difficult to do that sort of thing on a train now, certainly a British train anyway.
Yeah, you can't go from carriage to carriage.
No.
Well, certainly not in that way. And then you haven't got that little bit between like the carriage and the window, I guess.
Although I like the Michael Sheen sort of TV film we did. Was it last year or the year before? Last Train to Christmas. Did you see
it? Oh yeah. I didn't see that, but I saw trailers for it. It looked really good.
That's well cool, because
he travelled back in time a little bit, didn't
he? Yeah, basically every time he goes through a carriage, he's either going back or forward a decade.
Yeah,
and the decisions he makes in a previous carriage will affect like what he sees in the next one.
Yeah, it's quite. I didn't see it, but I saw a few trailers and saw bits of making of, and it just seemed quite an interesting twist.
It was really good. For just off the point, and it is off the point, because I'm an NHS staff member, we were offered free tickets in like a lottery to go and see Michael Sheen at National Theatre Live playing Nye Bevan.
Oh yes, any good?
So I went to see that, and it was absolutely terrific.
Yes, yeah, I've seen trailers for that because he's definitely the man to do it, isn't he? I think.
Yeah.
Playing of Welsh heritage for sure.
Yeah, and if once again, if you go and see any footage of Nye Bevan, he's got it about right.
Yeah, I do. I'm keen to check it out. Actually,
he's the man who, for those not in this country, he's the man who founded the modern NHS. And of course, NHS, we were offered the chance to go and see it. But yeah, I went to see that recently. But yeah, so you don't get those sort of shots on trains now with those self-contained sort of 6 to 8 seat carriages.
No, you don't. It's very romantic, isn't it? I mean, it kind of got. I was just thinking about like other sort of train movies. I mean, I've got this Strangers on a Train, obviously North by Northwest.
You can't make Brief Encounter on that now. You'd be in a big open carriage, and he'd be going, "Well, what are you two fussing about? You know, you shagged her."
But they were married. They were married.
Oh no! But they were agonising over just a couple of chats.
It's like, so you remember seeing him like his films like in the '80s? Like I don't know what it was in America and things like that, but.
Well, you know, go and see the Level 42 video for Something About You, 1985, when they still had those carriages.
Oh, gosh, yeah, that's it. Yeah,
I didn't see them. I remember Trading Places.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, I'd like to do one of those, obviously in Canada, but you can do, like, you can go on holiday and do a train ride across the Rockies. I'd love to do that. That'd be so cool.
Does that include the Creed films as well, or just the original Rockies? Where are you now, Rocky 2?
Rocky 5. Drago's gone. Oh, that's funny. I've been to New York and rode the subway, but I don't know how representative that is of other trains in America. I really can't tell you. I don't know, unfortunately.
That's where film stars go to get women, isn't it? I mean, you had it in Coming to America, you had it in Crocodile Dundee.
So
I'm assuming that's an everyday occurrence.
Well, this is kind of how you meet. It's certainly the depiction of like trains in movies is quite romantic, isn't it? Well, it's either quite deadly or dangerous, or romantic. So
it's never the train 6 hours late and the fucking like T's got a pube in it or something.
No,
it's not very realistic.
No, and obviously he had recently we had the bullet train, which I've not seen, but I've heard apparently it's brilliant. It's really good.
Well, brilliant's too strong. It's very good. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah, I've got to check it out. And then obviously
it's on Netflix now.
Oh, I'll check it out.
Dropped the other day, bullet train.
And then obviously we had Mission Impossible with the epic train stunt.
Ooh. Yeah, but it tends to be a lot more like about like more posher trains, isn't it? More, sort of.
It's not murder on the Guildford to Clapham, is it?
Murder on the 10-1 from Salisbury, no.
No, it's not like, you know, you get your standard, like, you know, just top into Edinburgh, you know, that kind of thing there.
Yeah.
You could probably fly for quicker as well, but yeah, I mean, it's very green, it's a very green way to travel, I guess. But yeah, as I say, it's probably not as romantic unless you go on like the Orient Express or you know a Watercress line or you know a heritage rail, you know, I think that they're called these days.
Yeah, we had an old steed train come through the town today actually.
Did you?
I didn't know about it until I saw the video on social media.
Yeah, that's really cool. We get them through Salisbury.
That might have been the Cornishman actually, which is a bit like the Flying Scotsman in terms of design. Yeah.
So I think it's the Scotsman that features in this film, doesn't it? I think obviously going to Scotland as he does.
Yeah.
So it's certainly a very.
No, it's the Ghanaian.
It's a different one entirely.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's a very kind of romantic sort of mode of travel. Certainly that's how it's depicted as well. And I suppose. Probably at this time, perhaps they might not have been very many cars on the road if it's a really popular mode of transport.
Yeah.
I don't know too much about it.
There was one line in the film where someone says about cars and he said, I didn't even know they were around 40 years ago. Yeah.
Well, that's true, yeah, a bit of a throwaway line. Oh, yeah, that's when he gets to... the old Crofter, the miserable old Crofter, who's actually John Laurie. They're all doomed. Private Fraser from...
Was it? Oh, wow. She's talking about Dad's Army there, which was a sitcom from the 60s and 70s. It ran from like 68 to 77, something like that. And with the exception of two of them, one of whom was young and played young and the other one was young and played old, they were mostly sort of pensioners. So most of them died within a few years of the show finishing. But the sort of very dour, miserable Scotsman in the show is about the Home Guard during World War II. So that's where people who didn't go away to fight stayed at home as sort of quasi-soldiers. And, John Laurie was a character in that. Yeah, he was. Yeah, I didn't realise it was Dame Peggy Ashcroft as his wife.
Yeah, Peggy Ashcroft as well, his much younger wife.
Yeah.
Who else we've got? Miles Madison pops up as a very quick cameo at the end. He usually appears in like comedies as like vicars and things like that. He appears in a few of the Ealing comedies and also the Jane Rutherford, Miss Marple movies as vicars.
Yeah.
I forgot who was in it. I'm trying to think who else really. Yeah, we should go through the cast, but as I say, but yeah, it took me a while to realise. I was like, hold on a minute, is that Private Fraser from Dad's Army?
I didn't know that.
No, he pops up in the Powell and Pressburger movie, I Know Where I'm Going.
So for example, roughly, I might be wrong by a year or so, but I think Dad's Army finished in 1977 and he died in 1980. So they were all quite old when they were in it.
It was towards the end of his career,
wasn't it? Yeah, so. Absolutely. Dad's Army's a show that I'll give you a personal and a public perspective on it. My personal perspective is I've never really got it. I've watched it a few times, never particularly liked it. But it is seen as like one of our best ever sitcoms, Dad's Army. It's absolutely beloved.
I always remember it being on as
like middle of Saturday afternoon.
Yeah, it was kind of the same shot. Like, it was the same slot as something like Hello, Hello, wasn't it?
Yeah, Sunday afternoon, that sort of thing. I kind of associate it because obviously my grandparents
just
were
after
really into it,
so. Just after grandstand or...
yeah. Like sort of weekend, Saturday, Sunday, tea time. Yeah. Slot.
When we got over the boring sport stuff, I was like, which I wasn't even interested in.
I'd rather watch some old men being humorous.
There's some episodes downright silly, but some episodes, you know, it still draws in quite a big audience share today.
I think that's what I'm saying. When I say I didn't like it, I'm stressing personal opinion. I won't say anything against it because greater minds than me think it's one of the best sitcoms we ever produced. There was a terrible film remake of it about 10 years ago.
Oh, Catherine Zeta-Jones.
Yeah, it was really bad. It was really poor. They got all the characters kind of right. Toby Jones was in it. Yeah.
Yeah, he was quite good.
But yeah, well, although he's a bit more sort of delicate than Arthur, whatever he's called, the guy who played Mannering in the TV show. Although he's a more delicate build than him, he did Arthur Lowe. Yes, thank you. I nearly said Arthur Sims, but I'm thinking of Alistair Sim. Which is nothing to do with him. So anyway. So I don't recognise many of this cast at all. I would say Robert Donat, but again, for one film. And although I recognise the name of some of the other films he was in, I don't think I've seen them. This again was Charles Bennett. He's been he's got quite a long association one way or another.
He's been associated with Hitchcock for a while, hasn't he? He actually appears and
but he wrote
when
Blackmail.
Hitchcock makes his cameo.
But he wrote Blackmail.
He's seen walking alongside. Mm.
But he wrote Black. He wrote the Blackmail stage show.
He did.
Yeah.
I hope that had more Blackmail in it.
Well, yeah. Not really any black. It should have just been called Running a Shop.
Running a shop.
Running a shop and handing out. How well do you think it would have done if they'd called it Running a Shop and Handing Out Free Breakfasts?
Yeah. Chatting up your customers.
Yeah. Okay.
Not to run a shop.
Shall we discuss this film sequentially?
Yes. So, we open. Where's this film set? Where did it start?
Well, we start off in London, I believe, and I don't know which theatre it is.
We start London and
London. It's a theatre, and it doesn't matter which one.
No, it's meant to be the Palladium, but...
No, the first
London
one
Music Hall Theatre.
No, it's not.
It's a musical.
It's not the Palladium at the stop. It's just a theatre.
It's just a musical theatre.
Where they're going to watch people, someone who remembers stuff. I don't know.
It was obviously back in the day, wasn't it? It was like a variety sort of show.
And the fact that and people are flocking to find out that like Wolverhampton Wanderers won 3-1 12 years ago. I just find that really hard to believe. That would be.
I thought it was quite funny. Like, one of the questions was like, "Oh, when did Chelsea win the cup or something like that?" And he was like, "Oh, in the Emperor and
yeah, he was asking
Emperor Nero time." Yeah.
But what made me smile was right. This is pre-internet. So if you turn up to see a guy called Mr. Memory and you go, in 1857, who won this? Presumably you don't know yourself. So you can just say anything, couldn't you?
Yeah, and then when he asks, am I right?
Yeah, you can just go, you can just go Bolton, right?
Maybe.
Just answer Bolton to everything.
But also, I think it'd be quite interesting to note also that the majority of the audience are very much working class.
Yes.
So they would probably perhaps not be well read as somebody like of Hannay, for example.
Yeah, so Becca's saying if you're working class, you're probably thick as shit.
Yes. that gentleman, you know, Chris, you said, you know, you want to find out what causes Pippin poultry. And that gentleman does, you know, there's a character there, a working class character, he does ask that question, and his wife is like, oh, don't make yourself sound so common, you know.
So I'll go with the second question, where do women like to stick eels?
Like, as common as muck and just not taking them seriously at all. Like,
well, literally, like, yeah, that's it. Because like, there's the
where's my husband?
Where's my old man? Mm-hmm. Probably down the pub.
And this guy, Mr. Memory, has absolutely zero charisma. It's like listening to a fucking answering machine.
Hello.
I don't know. I kind of like this like sort of fast delivery. It's like, am I right, sir?
Am I right, sir? Yes.
All right. So Richard,
he's very RP English, isn't he? He's very Chumley Warner.
So Richard Hannay is there watching this show. He's raced out to see, you know, Mr. Memory, and he even asked the question: how far is it from like Winnipeg to somewhere else? And again, just say anything. You probably don't know. 450.
Yeah, he's like, how far is it from Winnipeg to Montreal? And he just says any old number.
Wait, just say 456 miles. No one's going to know you're right or wrong. Anyway.
No. Apparently, fun fact early on, this film was quite popular in Canada because of Hannay being from Canada and the mention of Winnipeg, Montreal, etc., etc. So, and I think wasn't he like governor of Canada or something like that?
You
as well?
Could
so
just
it was quite popular.
Dub it, couldn't you? You could just dub it for different regions. If you wanted it to sell down here, you could have him say, how far from Truro to Plymouth? Right? And it would just be like, oh, I've got to go see that. They've mentioned it. How far to Cheltenham? Yeah. They should do that. They should do that more. They should do that more.
It's a movie phone, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. So you could have some film set in like America where they're going, yeah, I lost $1 million in Vegas, and they could dub it and they could say, I lost £1 million in Shrewsbury.
Salisbury.
yeah. It's a good idea. I can fix cinema.
Yes.
The post-COVID the post-COVID collapse would absolutely not happen if I was in charge.
No, we have it all
for start
on time.
This would be 37 steps. Save him some energy.
Save you some time, yes. Yeah. Much more efficient.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We probably remake
it
as
sort of like undersell it. Don't want to be like 36 because that's just, you know, you don't feel like getting your money's worth, do you?
No, exactly. I might even go 37 and a half to be fair.
Yeah, 37.
Because sometimes you go up some old building, there's some tiny little stone step at the top, which is barely a step.
If you just did it at 40, that'd be a nice even number, you know.
Oh, yeah. No, because they'll expect an epic.
Oh, God.
They'll expect, Lawrence of Arabia or something. That wouldn't be any good.
Yeah, but 36 seems like being short change, whereas, like, you know, 37 feels like getting a bargain.
If you've got an optimum number of steps, write to us at expectusatalk@gmail.com. But do remember the old Wembley Stadium, it was 39 steps to go and pick up the cup.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So if you say 36, they're going to stop one step earlier and the couple just be sat there.
Why was it 39? Was that particular...
I don't know. It's something like 100. It's something like 107 in the new Wembley, but they used to have to go... Footballers are fitter now, clearly. Because they used to look exhausted. It was all the sort of drinking and smoking all week that kind of damaged them. But yeah, it used to be 39 steps to go up the steps at Wembley to collect like the FA Cup or whatever. But at the old Wembley, which was demolished about 20 years ago.
Fun fact, folks.
Well, another fun fact. Do you know who the last manager to manage a team at Wembley was?
No.
Mike Bassett.
Oh!
Because they laid a little bit of grass and they just filmed it with him. They'd already closed it.
Oh, there was a film about him, wasn't there? With Ricky Tomlinson.
Yeah, that's it. Mike Bassett, England manager.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh. Yeah, I'll check that out.
Yeah. The best bit of that film is that the sequel?
No, they did
a sequel as a TV show where he was like managing a fourth division team or something. This is where he was the manager of England, right? He was the manager of Norwich, and like the current England manager has a heart attack because of all the stress and everything. And they offer it to everyone, and the only person who'll take it is him, who's like the Norwich manager, and he's just won the Mr. Clutch Cup, right? And what was funny is he goes on an open top bus parade to parade the cup. But they go the wrong way on the one-way system. Oh. So he's driving. They're driving down some fucking A road on a really cold day. And when they get back to the town, their hair's all stuck up and they're freezing. And he becomes the England manager, but it's really badly organised. Like Bradley Walsh is the assistant manager.
Oh,
and
wow.
They go to a training session. They don't have any balls at all. So they're playing air football.
Mind the detail.
Yeah. But yeah. But yeah, last manager to manage at Wembley, which is totally relevant to this film.
Fun fact, folks. Well, you know, we're known for going for tangents.
So anyway, they're watching Mr. Memory just make up any old random shit. And then
the thing is, though, I think the whole thing is like to kind of test him. So you'd ask a question that you know the answer to, which is why he says, "Am I correct, sir?" And he just sort of go, "Oh yeah, you are. That's right." apart from the guy.
But again, is that entertainment? Just watching stuff, someone tell you stuff you already know.
I suppose.
Don't know.
Like
maybe
though.
To a 1935 audience. I don't know.
Yeah.
Right. As I say, now we've all got like access to the internet and obviously encyclopedias and stuff like that. But as I say, this is very much like a working class audience. Yeah.
Do you think in a remake now it would have to be Mr. Wikipedia? Right?
Yeah,
and,
probably.
And you say to him, who won the FA Cup in 1954? And
Mr. Google.
And then he just, gets, yeah, Google, then he just gets out his phone and goes, it was whoever.
Let me check Wikipedia. Well,
I picked the wrong year then, because I don't know who won it in 1954. I should have said 1953, to be honest, because I know who won it that year. But anyway, go on.
There we go. This is it. Well, I think still, you know, sort of the modern equivalent would be like Britain's Got Talent. We don't really see, it's got to be kind of quite spectacular.
What, Ant and Dec?
Yeah, or those kind of talent shows that we have today. You don't really see kind of like feats of memory or anything like that. It's more kind of, it's a feat of endurance. You don't kind of see these kind of things, is it? Because it's very much, it is a bit old school. And you think it certainly wouldn't float today. Like audiences would be like, this is rubbish today. But yeah, it was probably something quite popular in the 1930s. I don't know.
Yeah, why don't you sing Westlife? You know,
I'd be very impressed if he'd sung Westlife in this film. Wouldn't you? I mean, if he sung...
I saw that once, you know, before they were famous, I think, when Ron Keating managed them. And they went on tour with Boyzone when they did a tour years ago in the 2000s, very early on in their career.
Yeah.
And I think back when they were called Westside.
Right, and where did you go? Where did you go and see them then?
Bournemouth, I think.
So it was it was still an arena show then. They must have been fairly big, unless you saw them in a pub there or something.
No,
it was Boyzone, wasn't it?
They were supporting Boyzone on their tour.
Right.
Obviously, I think it was before Stephen died.
Well, it would have been, otherwise there'd have been a corpse on stage.
No,
that
that's what I think when it was, it was quite a shock when he passed away. But yeah, that was nice, but I haven't seen them since. Obviously, you know, got the CDs and whatever, because into boy band stuff as you do when you're a teen in that time. And you think, oh no, and then you get into indie music, which is way better. So anyway, but yeah, so I did go see.
So were you more Boyzone fan rather than Take That?
Then I discovered Take That, and was like, yeah, they're a lot better. So, and then it was back
on
to
what,
boy band.
On, I've got to ask, and I mean this in no pejorative way, I'm just asking, on what metric? You're saying they're way better, and I'm just, on what metric?
On the handsomeness.
Oh, okay. So all the stuff you can hear on a vinyl LP. Right, okay, brilliant. Oh my god, he sounds like he's got tremendous chest hair. By the way, he sings "Ooh, Baby."
And as I say, then I discovered indie music and was like, yeah, actually,
This Do you know, I feel like we're not really discussing the 39 steps here.
No, I've got lots of stuff prepped and we're not getting through it, so come on.
What's what you prepped about boy bands and, like, prepubescent feelings?
Well, I won't go on about a massive rant about Thunderbirds
like I did last week. See, also, I'm a lot more, like, interested in asking Becca about her about her music taste. So I kind of go, okay, so...
choices.
Well, I want to know, she mentioned Thunderbirds in the same breath as well, and I don't think I've ever heard it in the same sentences. Take that. it would be like going, yeah, I loved Girls Aloud and the Antiques Roadshow.
Well, no, I was just saying, remember when we had that massive segue in Thunderbirds for some reason?
I was asking questions, to be fair, because I'm a bit of an investigator when it comes to these things.
No, that's okay.
All right, so
yeah, shall we get back to 39 steps?
So, in summary,
it's only an hour and a half, so come on, let's do it.
They hear gunshots, and he's like, "I wonder if this is something to do with a Germanic spy."
He just comes out of nowhere and goes, "I would like to come home with you."
This was all a bit forced, actually, but I didn't dislike it. But it was just a little bit like sloppy. But
it's a bit kind of a bit sort of pop.
There,
and
are,
tried,
shot, there are shots during this show. Everyone flees. As I think that's actually quite realistic in that you just would. You just run in panic. Oh, my God, what was that?
Yeah. Get the fuck out of there.
Yeah.
You don't know
And then she ends up saying she's the spy. Oh, no, she wants to go. She seems frightened and wants to, him to go back to his flat.
Want to go back to my place?
He's like, right, well, I'm in there.
She's frightened as well. I can give her a cuddle. So he takes her back to her house, where his name is in a completely different font and stuff from everybody else's on the list of
flats.
Yeah,
it's written quite large.
It looks like he was called something else until just before filming, and then they just went Richard Hannay over the top, right?
Just written 1930s lettering.
And she says, and then she immediately tells her the entirety of everything. She's never met this guy, and she goes, I'm a spy. And I fired the shots because I needed to elude people, including a man who's missing part of his finger. And he's stealing...
Yeah, but she's away the entire plot.
And he's stealing military inflammation. And then she goes, the 39 steps. Right, let's go to bed.
But that's pretty much the first half of this movie. Because I'm going to be murdered in that scene.
Yeah. I've got to get this out now because I'm not going to be suffering the sort of penetration you were hoping for. And a death scene is inadvertently funny when she comes in the door. He's in bed and she's obviously sleeping there, but not with him. She's in another room, and she comes in the door and she does the most ridiculously over the top I'm dying scene you could imagine.
It is very over the top, isn't it?
She's been stabbed in the back and she tells him to flee. And
yeah, she gives him a bit of paper
and she's got a map of the Scottish Highlands with an area sort of circled. So he immediately goes, well, that's my plan sorted. I'm on my way to Scotland.
Go there.
She could have just been planning a holiday and then she was, like, stabbed.
Although, what if he went, no, I don't want to do that.
Imagine, she could have been reading anything. Imagine, like, she'd come in and he'd gone, right, I need to go to the publishers of Penthouse. Because that's what she was... She could have been reading anything. But yes, it was to do, she's got to go to Scotland and it's something to do with the plot is up there. And this reminds me of later Hitchcock, because he genuinely does not know what's going on, but his life's in immediate danger.
It's pretty much kind of like, I mean, we see it in Psycho later on as well, don't we? It's just like the kind of the plot's still going, plot's still unfolding, and then all of a sudden, who you think is going to be the main character? Nope. Yeah. She dies. Spoiler alert for a film that's 60 odd years old.
Yeah, you think it's going to be these two, like, running around, like, from baddies, aren't you? But no.
And this actress, Lucy Mannheim, is German, compared with later, when we get someone playing Scottish, who isn't. She does sound like where she's from. I immediately thought she definitely is. Because Dame Peggy Ashcroft is playing Scottish later, and is not convincing at all.
No, she does a kind of, it's a very like over the top. I mean, obviously it was the 30s, there was a lot of over the top acting.
We mentioned Doc Martin earlier, and if you watched that or Beyond Paradise, I don't know if either of you have seen it.
Oh yeah.
Right. Well, for example, last week, did you watch last week's? Sorry to go on another tangent.
Seen it just yet. No, but it has a lot of like, especially with Doc Martin.
Is an episode on the iPlayer now, and it's the latest one, and it's got Jeff Rawl, who was not only in Doc Martin, but he's best known as George Dent from Drop the Dead Donkey.
Oh yeah,
and he is running like a museum in this episode. And that is one of the streets of Liscard where I live. Even though most of it is shot in Loo, that's less than a mile from me. It's in town. But yeah, they filmed some of it there. But the point I was about to make is whenever anyone is based down here, to the uninitiated, it might sound vaguely like I sound, but it isn't. It's a vaguely Bristolian accent they sort of do. And it's generic, and people down here don't sound like that. They just don't. It's kind of the right region in that it's vaguely a southwest accent, but it isn't in any way Cornwall or Devon. And Doc Martin was the same. They all do this generic kind of
West Country accent.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's the same here with some of the Scottish in this.
So imagine if you do have, I mean, because I've been on holiday to that region before, and you do kind of meet the occasional...
You came to my wedding.
I came to your wedding, definitely. But yeah, but you do sort of meet people who have, you know, kind of like Cornish, that might be like their first language, or
no one natively speaks Cornish. No. They've made efforts to protect the language as like culturally significant. So you'll see road signs and stuff like that sometimes in both language and street names.
Yeah,
like my street gives the name of the street, and underneath it, it's got it written in Cornish.
Yeah.
But it's actually a dead language. Until about the mid-90s, just after I took my GCSEs, you could do a GCSE in Cornish, but the last year, literally two students did it, so they discontinued it. No one natively speaks it now.
Oh, that's a shame.
But people do keep the language alive, in that there are people who can speak it in the same way as like a British person might be able to speak German or something, but it doesn't mean they're a native.
No.
Yeah.
They speak
it
with an accent.
Yeah. And so anyway, yeah, but that reminds me of Eddie Izzard talking about Latin, where he said, well, how do we know what the accent was? And so he kind of just says it like this. Puella.
Very refined way.
Yeah, you just don't know, do you?
Well, no, you don't. That's true, exactly.
So anyway, he's on this train going towards Scotland to find out what's going on. And he finds out at the station...
Well, he sneaks out by as a milkman.
The conversation that he has with the milkman is quite funny.
Yeah.
It's like, you're having an affair. Oh, well, why did you say so? Right.
Yeah. That's really funny how, like, he tries to kind of get away. So, look, the woman's been murdered upstairs. There's an international spy ring. And the milkman's like, pull the other one. And he's actually like, well, hold on a minute. Are you married? He's like, well, I am, but don't rub it in. And he basically says, well, look, you know, I've had an affair with this woman upstairs. There's two men outside. One's a husband. The other's her brother. And he's like, oh, say no more, you know.
And it's like, yeah, I was half expecting, like, reveal, like, that the milkman was end up getting murdered, being mistaken for him.
Yeah, that's true, actually.
I was kind of half expecting that to be a reveal kind of thing, you know.
Yeah.
Mm. Milkman did it all along.
Well, no.
Yeah, there's quite a few twists and turns, so you don't quite know what's going to happen, do you? It's a bit twisty.
But yeah, he finds out towards sort of Edinburgh somewhere that there's a manhunt for this murderer. They just assume he's murdered this woman in his apartment. And so they notice the police are sort of searching the train. So he walks into a compartment and thinks, I know what I can do to get away with this. Get myself a honey. and he kisses he just kisses this woman Pamela, and they just walk straight past the compartment.
Pamela.
But yeah.
Sorry.
I think
it's quite funny, like, prior to this as well, they get when he gets on the train, there's like a completely random scene with two characters who don't talk about anything to do with the plot, but we'll never see them again. I think it's just another example. It's they briefly mentioned the naughty limerick that I said at the top of the show.
This is feeling less like the infancy of cinema than the previous weeks, but it's still got that element of what do we have people say? So in the previous weeks, we've had like, there's too much exposition, isn't there? Let us go to the pub. And it's like, well, just show us you in the pub. We'll get it.
There's a bit too much buzzing.
And so I think they've got these guys on the train and they think we've got to have them say something. So it's absolute irrelevant shite.
Yeah, it's just an excuse for Hitchcock really to be a bit naughty and to try and like get around that code if he can, which of course he doesn't. But yeah, it's just completely random. I think in the 1950s version, it's all the schoolgirls because they're playing netball, obviously traveling up to Scotland for their school or something like that, for example. I don't think it's included in the 70s version, and the 2008 version I cannot remember. But I just thought it was quite funny how, like, there's something that's quite saucy, you know, quite a little bit cheeky as well. But it's just completely random. And it's like, why is it there? And it's probably just, you know, just a reason, just a sort of like Hitchcock kind of being quite impish, really. But I think if you could make any cuts to this film, just chop them out. Yeah. As I say, it's just, it's completely random. It's so irrelevant.
But I must stress, this film doesn't really have pacing problems. It's not slowing anything down,
no,
is it?
No, literally, it does rattle
along. And every film so far we've done, because they were so early in the life of cinema, they've all had slight pacing problems. This is the first one that hasn't.
No.
So
just was gone.
Yeah. So anyway, Pamela basically gives him up to the police, and he basically escapes that, and then he just ends up at some random house, doesn't he?
Yeah, Skyfall.
It does a bit Skyfall house. I think Hallie's quite. It's amazing how I'm not sure it does in the novel. Listeners, if you've read the book, let us know. But I can, in this film, certainly he kind of.
Is James Bond in the book?
He is.
Write to us and expect us to talk at gmail.com. Is Albert Finney in the book?
Are you a proto-Bond? Drop us an email. But yeah, he's kind of one, he's very much kind of thinks on his feet. He kind of, he's got quite a lot of ingenuity. He escapes an amazing amount number of times. It's like, how does he do it? But yeah, he kind of got that really amazing scene, like crossing of the train, crossing the fourth bridge. And this is kind of where we go away from the sets, I suppose, away from the studio, and in Scotland. So this is one of the most famous things about this movie, is its use of location footage and location photography as well. And it's kind of a real showcase. I mean, these films are travelogues as much as anything. Same with Bond, you know, when these films came along, it was a bit of a kind of a world showcase, really. It's like international travel was just taking off. Like, package holidays were very much new. And we're starting to become popular at that time in the 60s. And this kind of does a similar sort of thing here as well. It showcases, you know, sort of Scotland and the sort of great expanse.
Yes and no, because bits of it are definitely shot in a studio.
Some of the scenes are quite obvious. Mm. I was watching a few like YouTube videos, like analyses and stuff like that. And there are some scenes where, like, there's... I think it's a scene, yeah, when you've got Pamela... Honey and the two spies in the car, and there's an edit where they get in the car and drive off, and there's a cut made like towards the rear of the car, and then the next shot is you see them kind of driving through the Scottish Highlands, which is amazing, and it was quite innovative for the time. Today it's a common cut that you see in many action movies, but back then, 1935, it had perhaps not been seen that common. It wasn't that common. It hadn't been seen before.
Sorry, what hadn't been seen before?
Yeah, there's an edit.
You told me about this off air and I didn't spot what you meant.
No,
mainly because I watched the second half of it on a phone, to be fair. But
No,
I was happy with it. I could see it. I was just trying to do stuff and get through it. And I watched it attentively, but there is a possibility on that side you miss a couple of details. What do you mean by an edit?
So it's a very quick cut, basically. So, guys, go and watch the film again.
I'm definitely not anytime soon, but I'm definitely watching it again. I enjoy it.
No, it's one of those. It's really kind of the trick is with good editing, you shouldn't really notice it.
True.
But it's one of those things where it's not something now. It's, you know, it's a common edit that's kind of made. It's literally like they're in the car, and it goes from like the rear of the car, and then the next scene is the car driving through a really long winding road through like rolling, Highland, Scottish scenery, as the car drives away. But it's a very quick cut. The way it's done is in a very modern way, or it certainly seems quite modern to my sensibility. But back then, it's probably something that hadn't been seen, very often. And I think also, just to go back to the scene on the whilst he's escaping off the train, there is a scene where I think as he just gets back off the train, there's a woman seen screaming. And as she kind of, the woman turns to the camera and screams, and the noise of a scream is like a sort of a choo-choo train sound. Again, so it's another quite interesting edit, quite similar to the beginning of The Lodger, for example, which opens with a woman screaming, but it's like it's the orchestral score so that sort of thing. So it's, again, it's a callback. So I just, you know, it's just one of these little things where I think it's quite quite innovative.
Oh yeah, so definitely. Just thought I'd point that out. So plot wise, he goes to see this couple and basically says he gives himself a different name because I think he calls himself Hammond or something like that.
Is Hammond expense?
He says nothing about the difficulty he's in, but asks for somewhere to stay. He's asked for a certain amount of money, or he offers to pay. And it's an older guy who seems very religious with his younger wife. The younger wife
being... Oh, this is the crofter, isn't it? This is John Murray.
I don't know what a crofter is, to be fair, but what's a crofter?
So, croft, I think, is a type of... it's not a bothy, is it? It's kind of like a Scottish residence. Let's have a look, crofter. He's basically a farmer.
Okay. Yeah, okay.
Is it a man
who beats
his wife?
Oh, yeah, he does give his wife a whack off screen later. I mean, this guy's nuts. She does one thing to help this guy, and she must be making love to him.
Again, this another amazing thing about this film. It plays with genre as well. I mean, as Hitchcock does with a lot of his films, like it's murder mystery, it's adventure, it's travel, it's domestic violence.
Yeah.
So it just kind of traverses all the genres, unfortunately.
He reads in the newspaper at this point that there's a nationwide manhunt after an incident at the Fourth Bridge, which is where he escaped. So I think he tells the wife what's going on. And to cut a long story short, it isn't a long story. This isn't a particularly padded film, but we can cut down a little bit of this in that the husband, she knows her husband will hand this guy in for money because that's all he cares about. And so she helps him get away. She gives him his coat, complete with a book in it, which will be relevant, and helps him get away because the police turn up and she says, yes, he's absolutely asking what reward there is. He will tell the police what's going on. And she helps him away, and he heads to see the police, doesn't he? In Scotland.
Yeah.
But it turns out the chief of police
goes to he goes to that place in Scotland where that's been circled.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He goes to this location that.
Oh, the Sherlock.
Yeah, the spy had, and ends up meeting the guy with the bit of the finger missing, who basically suggests he shoots himself. He just basically says, well,
but it turns out
you shoot yourself
police,
or I'll shoot
you. The chief of police is quite friends with this guy, Professor Jordan.
Absolutely. So
I think he's kind of like, he's like the main villain of the movie, but we didn't spend a lot of time with him. And again, he's kind of in that vein as with like the, what's his name? Peter Lorre, a sort of villain who's quite, very upper class, very cultured. You don't know right away that he's a villain as such until you see that he's got a digit missing.
Yeah, so you don't really know what the full story is either, do you? So you're like...
No, you don't. He's a bit of mystery. So again, he's kind of like that proto-Bond villain almost. Obviously, he's working against national interests somehow. But yeah, you don't know too much about him, really.
I think what I like about him is that how casual and just how that, like, he could literally be talking about anything, like literally just like a casual business deal kind of thing. It's just the way he just delivers it, but he's actually talking, it's like, well, a bit different here.
We've talked about the later film, but
you're gonna have to shoot yourself, aren't you?
It reminded me of James Mason, in that the equivalent scene with James Mason. You know that James Mason knows he holds all the cards.
Yeah.
So it's like you would be relaxed because you've got the upper hand immediately.
Yeah, he's very chill with it all, isn't he? He's kind of very much in that James Mason vein. He's kind of very, very smooth, very suave.
And with the next bit, I think this is where the film just changes gear. And what I mean by that is, my observation at this point, if I'd switched it off, was North by Northwest, but with none of the humour. There were a couple of little bits, but largely anyway. And then he gets shot and it gets like caught in a book, which they all find quite funny, almost like the film is calling out as a bit of a silly plot device. And then from thereafter, the film is really kind of full of charm and humour.
Well, it's a prayer book, isn't it? They kind of, obviously, because the farmer is deeply religious. And I think, yeah, it's kind of, I mean, I think one of the writers in this film is Ian Hay, I think his name. I'm not familiar with him. I think in his association with really early Hitchcock movies, and perhaps this one. But apparently he was kind of known for like his really kind of witty dialogue. So you have like a few jokes earlier in the film, which may have been perhaps funnier to a 1930s audience, I don't know. Yeah, things about like the milkman, you know, I'm married but don't rub it in. And just kind of little lines like that, for example, and about the prayer book. You know, some of these prayers are quite difficult to get through. So it's filled with these little, quite funny little lines, which perhaps might fall on, which may have been funnier to audiences at the time, but perhaps, and unless you know what to listen out for.
I don't necessarily mean because North by Northwest was so much in my head. Cary Grant is so effortlessly charming in that film that this film did feel a bit stiff by comparison, but only in the first half. As soon as he teams up with Pamela again, the film is actually very funny.
Yeah, it tends to be a bit of a problem, doesn't it? Well, not a problem, but I think it's just to our modern sensibilities, obviously older films, because everyone is so stiff, and it is very much the way Robert Donat speaks is very much kind of RP Chumley Warner, you know, see pronunciation, whereas now obviously you know, kind of a bit more, it is more common to hear Norwegian accents, and sort of me going umming and ahhing and things like that, you know, and it's just more kind of less traditional kind of like modes of speaking. I mean we'll hear it again sort of even sort of like 50s and things like that, for example, and 60s again you hear a lot of yeah, hello, you know, sort of like RP English stuff like that, which is quite funny, because and then again like once you come to sort of like Frenzy, for example, towards the end of the series, again you've kind of, I mean, still got London accents, for example, but you've got more sort of Cockney creeping in, you've got kind of more local dialects kind of creeping in as well, but yeah, I think it's just one of those sort of symptoms, really, certainly to our modern sensibilities of the earlier films, really, where everyone is a little bit stiff, there is a lot of RP, and it just sounds a bit alien really to us, but that doesn't make it a bad thing, it's still accessible. But I would kind of agree that yeah, once they get away, you know, once they sort of arrive in Scotland, things really do start, you know, start to pick up, and from here on in it's just, yeah, it's very, very witty, very zingy, quite good dialogue, especially the relationship between the two leads as well, it kind of gets a lot better, and they have really good chemistry and they do have good banter, as you say, Dave. I hate that term as well, but just the back and forth between them is quite zingy, which is really good. So
yeah, I like it. I do think it's a bit jarring for when you get shot, because it's a bit like, where are we, what's going on? But then he wakes up in a police station, and the police chief's quite friendly. He's quite understanding. He's like, oh, yeah, sure. We'll clear those up straight away, you know, just wait for my colleagues to come. And as soon as they come, he's like, oh, thank God.
Then he gets thrown down the river.
He escapes again. Hitchcock likes his people jumping out of windows.
The amount of time that he escapes in this movie, I think he can probably take a shot every time and you'll be crunk by the end of the film.
Mm. But he now escapes into some political meeting, and is mistaken for the guest speaker. So he has to sort of improvise that.
Where is the guest speaker?
I don't know, actually.
No, but yeah, what happens to him? Mr. Fraser, whatever his name is, but yeah, and they... But he gives this really, you know, amazing, rousing speech about not feeling lonely, and seems to, you know, seems to enamour himself to the audience. So, again, he's kind of quite resourceful, isn't he? He kind of thinks on his feet quite a lot.
Yeah, and then Pamela appears with what she thinks are police.
Yeah, she randomly appears again. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh, okay.
Yeah. And they're supposedly arrested, but she's told she's got to go with them, and then they're handcuffed together, and it's quite clear, well, it's not clear to her at the moment, she's wondering what's going on, and then when they're stopped by like sheep across the road, they escape again, get themselves to some sort of guest house, and it's there that eventually they pretend to be a married couple, they're sort of roomed together, and then she goes out, she manages to uncuff herself from him, goes out into the sort of lobby area up on the stairs, and overhears the guys talking to the staff.
Yeah, hears the guys talking. Again, in the middle there, you've got that famous scene where like she has to try to take off her wet stockings, and this is kind of a scene that's parroted in all the kind of remakes, really, where like obviously she's handcuffed to, you know, handcuffed to each other, and he's like, oh, can I help you? And it's basically to try not to basically grab her. But it's played for quite comedic effect. And it's a good example of their chemistry together, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. But she now obviously knows that this is not what she thought it was, because all the way through she's just assumed she's with some murderer. He's made some jokes about it, you know, when he first murdered at 19 and stuff like that, which is just all made up nonsense for a laugh.
Is it? Or is he telling the truth? Because we don't know too much about
it. Well, no, we don't, to be fair, but it's unlikely. And so she now knows what's going on.
That would be a twist. It's like, yeah, actually, I'm like...
Just
not this time.
And we're getting very close to the end of the film now. They end up sort of back in London at the Palladium, because they hear that they overhear that they're going to be at the Palladium, and Mr. Memory has now upgraded to the most famous theatre in London.
Yep, he's done very well for himself and that show.
Yeah, and Donut works, Honey works.
There's this tune that Honey kind of whistles to himself, and he's like, oh, yeah,
and he's heard
it. Turns out it's Mr. Memory's theme tune.
It is. It was her hinting to him, basically, the German spy. And so he then realizes, he's went, hang on a minute, this is why there's no paperwork. He's holding all the secrets, because he's the memory guy. Head. And just as he's about to shout out, he's about to be arrested. And then he shouts out, what are the 39 steps? Come on, answer. And screams out, what are the 39 steps? And the guy actually just spills all of it. And as he's about to get all of it out, he gets shot. And then what made me smile is he gets him backstage. He finishes telling them that it's some silent airplane or something. And then he dies. And Richard Hannay thinks, I'm in here, and grabs the lady's hand.
Holds her hand and like, huh. They all live happily ever after.
Yeah, remember when we met over that corpse? Yeah.
It was a love story all along.
Yeah, it was a love story all along.
It was happily ever after, even though he died. Oh.
Love at first. Love at first. Non-consensual kiss.
Love at first. Mouth rape.
Mouth rape would. No, I'm not even going to go there.
Sorry, that's a bit offensive. he does kind of force himself upon her, but his reasons for doing it are honourable.
It's just a desperate move. I don't think we should read too much into it, to be honest.
No, it was a plot device for a film made in 1935.
He's very apologetic afterwards. He's like, look, listen, I am in a bit of trouble here. I'm sorry.
To be fair, I do feel a bit sorry. I mean, Madeleine Carr, the female leads in this film are fantastic. I do kind of agree that. Obviously, Hitchcock was known for like treating his ladies a little bit rough, really, to be honest, and giving them a hard time. But I think because he knew that they were worth it, if that makes, like he knew that they would give it back, sort of thing. You know, they can go toe to toe with him, sort of thing. That doesn't excuse it and doesn't make it right at all. But I think it's just one of those things where like he would sort of tease and he would sort of make comments because he knew he would get it back. And that was just part of his personality, but so it doesn't excuse it, doesn't make it right for sure. But again, you know, it was a film that was made in 1935. It's just like a plot contrivance, really, just so he could stumble upon, you know, somebody who would go on to be like the female, you know, the female lead co-star, really. And you know, don't want to read too much into it, really. If that's okay.
I mean, he could have like, you know, caught on to like someone who's like, oh wow, she might be thinking, oh wow, we're monsters over here, like, and he's like, oh thanks for that, and she goes, oh, hey, where are you going?
Yeah, they're the probably ways that you could do it a bit differently these days, wouldn't you? So
yeah, and she thought it would come actually have her chasing him as well, you know, so he's like, oh
well, so there could be a modern version where it's, I don't know, Rebecca Hannay on the run, you know, or you know, the roles are reversed, so you never know.
So that's it, and I must say this is comfortably the best film we've seen so far. It feels a lot like more modern Hitchcock, but with the later stuff, obviously I'm picturing it mostly as American era, so the sort of stiff Britishness of it does stand out. But yeah, really, really enjoyable, and I've not got much more to add to that, really.
Yeah, it's basically... Well, say like a little bit like kind of continue on from last week, really. Obviously, it is that kind of thing, and it does ring very much true to North by Northwest. Overall, it's a decent film.
Yeah, Becca.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. To be fair, this is kind of like probably one of my least watched early Hitchcock movies. But yeah, I watched it quite a few times in prep for this and just had an absolute blast, really. It does kind of zip along. I mean, the first half is probably a little bit on the dry side, but there's quite some witty dialogue. Quite cheesy dialogue. But yeah, and then once they go up to Scotland, it's really great fun. As I say, it's very much kind of like proto Bond, proto North by Northwest, proto Man You Knew Too Much, almost in that kind of chase aspect. So much so that some of the remakes, they do have their own North by Northwest crop dust at the moment. It's certainly something that pops up in the 70s remake, and also in the 2008 remake. I think there's that scene with Hannay darting across the Highlands and the plane swoops down, so there's a little homage there. And it's kind of, you know, sort of a proto kind of spy mystery drama, really. You can trace it all back to here, I think. Really good fun. Listeners, if you've not, you know, if you're a bit less inclined to check out early movies, old movies, especially because they're in black and white, do seek this one out. You'll have a really good time, and it sort of just under 90 minutes, an hour and a half.
Several versions on YouTube.
Lots of different versions on YouTube. There is one, I think it's like Cult Cinema Channel or something like that. It's got a colourised version, which is not offensive at all.
I didn't watch the colourised version.
It's quite sensitively done.
I basically, when I was arranging them a few months ago when we were getting the schedule together, I put two versions in Watch Later, and one was the colourised, but it was the second one, so I just watched the first one and it was perfectly fine, but I did have it there.
Yeah, definitely. It's quite sensitively done. Like the colours are almost kind of like opalescent almost, which are just very nice to see. It's not nothing too garish, or, you know, anything like that. But yeah, there's, you can pick it up sort of on DVD because it's fallen into the public domain, or it's available on YouTube. Check it out. Yeah, I recommend this film for sure.
Okay. But can you convince them with some facts?
Luckily, I haven't got 39 facts, so I don't actually have the poultry fact as well. So I think it's caused by some germ. You'll have to look it up. I've got some fun facts. Fun fact number one. This features on all kinds of top British movie lists. So in 1999, BFI did a list of top 100 British films. Amazingly, Powell and Pressburger have four films on the list, but this one is the only Hitchcock film to feature on the list. There are also two Bond movies on the list, Dr. No at number 41 and Goldfinger at number 70. What else? In 2004, total film named it the 21st great British movie ever made. And in 2011 ranked it the second best book to film adaptation of all time. The Village Voice in America ranked it number 112 in its top 250 best movies of the century. Empire ranked the film at number 52 on its list of 100 best British movies. And it's regularly kind of tops the best British movie sort of lists, as it were. Orson Welles ranked it as one of his favourite movies, said, "Oh my God, what a masterpiece," in an Orson Welles accent. And of course, in 1939, he started a radio adaptation of the same source novel for Mercury Theatre on Air, apparently. And it has a 96% Rotten Tom's rating. Then that doesn't stand for much. But it's one of those films where it does kind of, you start to see it kind of charting on the best of British lists. So there we go. Fun fact number two, Madeleine Carroll and Robert Donat met each other on their first day of filming. When they filmed the scene where they run across the countryside, Hitchcock apparently handcuffed them two together, and then claimed he didn't know where the key was or he'd lost it. Just kind of put them in the right frame of mind for kind of being sort of handcuffed together. So they develop that chemistry through being handcuffed together, which I think is hilarious. I think had they not have been, they perhaps might not have formed that chemistry. Fun fact number three, as we mentioned, the 39 sets have been remade a few times, 1959 with Kenneth Moore, 1978 with Robert Powell, and 2008 with Rupert Penry Jones. Plus, it's also an award-winning play, which weaves in other Hitchcockian elements and films as well. I think it's also remade as a Bollywood musical. I don't know. I need to check that out. Fun fact number four, one of the matte artists on this film was a gentleman called Albert Whitlock, who you might not have heard of him, but he would go on to do the special visual effects on The Birds, Marnie. I was also a matte artist on Psycho 2, which we'll cover in this series. But he also worked on Willy Wonka, Diamonds Are Forever, Frenzy, The Sting, and many more. So he kind of launched his career here. My final fun fact, Madeleine Carroll went on to be known perhaps more for her wartime humanitarian work as well as for a film career. After her sister Margaret was killed in a London bombing raid, Carol worked for field hospitals in for the Red Cross as a nurse. And for her work in France, she was awarded the Legion of Honour. She was one of Hitchcock's first Ice Cool Blondes, and was at the time, certainly when the time this film was made, sort of late 30s, early towards the 40s, she was one of the highest paid actresses in Hollywood, and her salary was reportedly higher than $250,000, which is quite a lot of money for the time. So yeah, I didn't know about that. She's kind of known better for humanitarian work than she was a movie career. So, yeah.
Her second marriage was Sterling Hayden, and we've seen Sterling Hayden's been in lots of things, but the thing we know him from this show was he was Captain McCluskey in The Godfather, the one who broke Michael's jaw.
Yes.
Lucy Mannheim, who played the German spy earlier in the film, was married to Marius Göring, who's best known for Paul and Pressburger, was in The Red Shoes.
Yeah, he pops up a few times. Mm. We'll definitely come to that later on in the show. So.
Okay, that's obviously tremendous fun, folks.
I think he pops up in Waltzes from Vienna, which we are not covering on the series.
Right.
So yeah, it's another Paul Pressburger Hitchcock connection.
Yeah, and that's it for connections I can think of. And as I say,
I've got loads coming.
I can only recommend Goodbye, Mr. Chips, though. Either version, even yeah, the TV remake is pretty good, but the 1939 version is very good. So about 4 years after this, and that's what he will always be best known for. I can't remember what else he made. Let me just look at his filmography to see if there's anything else I remember there. He was in a version of The Count of Monte Cristo.
Oh, I need to see that as well. I've only ever seen the animated version.
Okay.
He made quite a few films, didn't he?
He only made 19 films, and that's because of his poor health, but he died at the age of 53 anyway. He had a brain tumour.
Oh my God.
So he didn't live to an amazing
age. I might have seen that actually.
So yeah, there's a few things there worth seeing. Born and raised in Manchester, went to Manchester Grammar School.
Oh really?
Yeah. Yeah.
He didn't have an accent.
No, not at all. But then it did kind of get bullied out of them in this era if you wanted to be an actor.
Oh, that's true. That's a shame.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and obviously Dame Peggy Ashcroft, who you will know from a number of things. What's Dame Peggy Ashcroft best known for?
I don't know. That's a good question.
What's she best known for? Hang on.
I have to look her up.
Didn't she play Marple or something? I'm not sure. Yeah, probably best known for theatre, but I'm trying to think what film she's been in. Oh, she was in The Jewel and the Crown. And A Passage to India.
Ah, Passage to India, that's it.
And she won an Oscar for Best Supporting Actress for that.
Maybe next time, when we do a Who's In It, we do Who's In This Film, I'll do a strand of like what else have we seen them in.
Yeah, absolutely.
We'll do a connection.
She was in Sunday Bloody Sunday.
When the Wind Blows?
Yeah. Yeah, that's the one where Ricky Gervais is in a crap factory, isn't it? You having a laugh? Yeah, loads and loads and loads of stuff. Quite a bit of it for television. But
yeah, she's got quite exhaustive CV, hasn't she? Okay. So.
Anyway, as for social media, you can find me at ThePastyKid1976 on Twitter.
Hey, you can find me at Cerotronics. You can also find all the odd episodes on Poppy.
You can find us on socials at Expect Us to Talk on Facebook. Do Expect Us to Talk on Twitter, X, at Expect Us to Talk on YouTube. Just search for Do Expect Us to Talk. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Podbean, Podbay. Basically, wherever you get your podcasts, you can support us by any one of various ways. Listening to us, thank you very much. Subscribing and leaving a 5-star review on whichever platform you're listening to us on. But wherever you are, don't forget to rate, review, like and share on your podcatcher of choice. Thank you very much.
Okay. And once again, I don't actually know what's coming next, which means Becca.
Do Expect to Talk will return with Sabotage.